Your attachment style is about the firing and wiring you get, right? That's, think of your attachment style as being the conditioning of patterns that you're exposed to repeatedly. You'll know that a boundary is correct in your life if you're making it from truth instead of from fear. It doesn't actually matter what their attachment style is. It mattered, are they both here and willing to do the work? So things can change that if we have enough repeated repetition and emotion, it can refire and wire new neural networks, new neural pathways.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. Are you ready? Let's do this. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Oh my goodness, friends, I am so excited, so thrilled to release this episode. It is game-changing information. It has personally revolutionized my life and so many people that I know. I had been dying to do an episode on attachment style theory for so long. So when I came across the work of Thais Gibson, I knew I had to have her on the show. Her newest book, Learning Love, is all about the attachment styles, which basically determine how you relate to other people in your relationships, how you communicate, how you react to them, how you treat them, and it explains actually why relationships often don't work or fail. Your attachment styles are determined in your childhood and can manifest in four main ways, one of which is secure and the other three are insecure. And we talk all about that in today's episode. You're going to learn why you do what you do in relationships, why you treat people the way you treat them, so many things. And I am so obsessed with Thais's work that I wanted to work with her in the long term because she has an incredible online personal development school where you can learn all about the attachment styles and change your relationships for the better. We're partnering with her on the Intermittent Fasting podcast for that, so you can actually get 50% off a monthly membership when you use the code IFPODCAST at ifpodcast.com/development. So again, that is for unlimited access to the ultimate platform to improve your relationships with all of Thais's attachment theory work. You get tailor-made on-demand courses and programs, daily live webinars, study groups, and Q&A sessions with Thais herself, as well as so many other things. So definitely check that out. Again, that is ifpodcast.com/development. Use the coupon code IFPODCAST to get 50% off that. The show notes for today's episode will have a full transcript as well as links to everything that we talked about. That will be at melanieavalon.com/attachment style. And there will be two episode giveaways for this episode. One will be in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers, Intermittent Fasting plus Real Foods plus Life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram, find the Friday announcement post, and again, comment there to enter to win something that I love. All right, I think that's all the things. As a brief reminder, you can get 50% off Thais Gibson's personal development school at ifpodcast.com/development with the code IFPODCAST. Hi, friends. Did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them, and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/melanieavalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit, as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/melanieavalon. And new customers, use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hi friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient-dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy to eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii. Not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. And now, without further ado, please enjoy this fabulous conversation with the beautiful, incredible, amazing Thais Gibson. Hi, friends. Welcome back to the show. I am so incredibly excited about the conversation I'm about to have. It is about a topic that I have been wanting to do an episode on for years, years and years and years. Interestingly, so I'll just mention the topic, which is people's attachment styles. I've actually in the past been pitched, I think a few times, different people wanting to come on the show for specific attachment styles. And each time I was like, I would love to do that and learn more. But then I had this fear that maybe if I focused on just one, people would listen and everybody would maybe think they were that one style. So I was like, I'm going to wait. And I know like the perfect opportunity is going to come and it's going to be an overview of everything. And then that happened. So when I got an email from the team with Thais Gibson for her new book, Learning Love, Build the Best Relationships of Your Life with Integrated Attachment Theory, I was an immediate yes. She also has a book prior to that. It's a bestseller. It's called Attachment Theory, A Guide to Strengthening the Relationships in Your Life. And so friends, I read this book and every now and then you read a book and you just realize that the entirety of humanity could read this book because I think it would help so many people. I learned so much about myself. I learned so much about what I see in other people in their relationships. I've been recommending this book to everybody. In fact, my assistant who helps me edit my notes, she was like, I have to read this book. And then she read the book just from reading my notes about it. It was just so mind-blowing to learn how these attachment styles
how they're formed, where they come from, how you can address them, and how they affect things like your core beliefs and your emotional patterns and your expectations and relationships and your boundaries and your needs and your coping mechanisms and communication and all the things. So I have been looking forward to this for so, so long. Thais, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for such a lovely introduction. I appreciate that. And it's always so fun to chat with people who are as excited and passionate about things as you are. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, I'm just so excited about this. And so I mentioned your books. Quick question for listeners, your personal development school that you have doing all of this work, what came first, the books or the school? What was the journey there?
Yeah, I worked in private practice for a while. And then I had about a 2-year wait list with clients. And I really care about people. And I wanted to really be there. And I just felt like not so great about telling people, yeah, I'd love to help you in 2 years. Like, it just wasn't a great sort of system. So I did start doing a whole bunch of like online workshops and teaching classes online. And then wrote our first book right after that. So launched the personal development school about 5 years ago after being in private practice for 7-8 years before that. And then wrote the second book just last year, which is sort of like the conglomeration of everything distilled down. So personal development school helps. We have like a whole bunch of peer support groups and things like that. And courses to really, like, it's almost like an attachment bootcamp to heal your attachment style. But then the book is like the summary of everything content wise.
Awesome. And to that point, it's a really approachable, I don't want to say easy read because that makes it sound like simple, but it's a really approachable read, like the perfect length. This is why, like, I feel like literally everybody should just read it.
Thank you.
So many questions here. The concept of attachment theory, and you have your own, you know, approach to it. You talk about the history of it in the book. I'm super curious when it came across your radar. Did you slowly integrate it into your work? Did you have an epiphany surrounding it one day? Of course, I'm dying to know. And we have to talk about the attachment styles, but I can't wait to hear what yours is. And you were asking what mine was before this. When did you first, you know, zone in on this concept?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So I actually learned about it in first year university psych class. And I went to school for psychology and was like, you know, interested always in like the mind and all these things. But it was just such a brief introduction to it. It's like, here's the attachment styles and here's how they can affect your relationship. So I came across it really briefly then. I had a lot of work to do on myself as a person. I had a lot of healing to do. I came from a really turbulent childhood with a lot of like extreme highs and lows and just ups and downs. Saw a tremendous amount of fighting growing up between my parents, really kind of nasty divorce. And I think I just grew up like internalizing a lot of that as a sensitive person. And with a lot of that chaos, I became a fearful avoidant attachment style, which is often referred to as disorganized attachment style. And so, you know, I saw a lot of those really big extremes growing up with how intense and heated things could get. And I was like, oh, relationships are scary. They're chaotic. You know, there's some really good moments around love and there's some really scary ones. And so I was in school, had a lot of self-growth to do, actually ended up by about third year university having to just deeply work on myself and really go inwards, struggling with a lot of like addictive habits that I was going through, a lot of relationship problems in a big way. And I eventually was like, okay, I'm the common denominator and I should actually just figure out what's going on with me. And I got really, really passionate about learning, like about healing and really in more tangible ways. So did a whole bunch of work in hypnosis, the subconscious mind. I learned that your conscious mind can't outwill or overpower your subconscious mind. And your subconscious mind itself is responsible for 95 to 97% of your beliefs and your thoughts and your behaviors and emotions. And so I was like, geez, what's in there? And that was something nobody was really talking about like 15, 16 years ago. Yeah, I just went really deep into this whole journey of learning and obsessively researching. And I revisited attachment styles after doing a lot of other work on myself, revisited attachment styles when I met my now husband about 10 years ago. I had done a lot of other work, had come a long way in my own healing and journey. And I was really single for a while and really focused on myself for a little bit. And then eventually got into a relationship with him and was like, wait, there's some patterns here that don't make sense. And I went back and looked at my own patterns, looked at his patterns. He was a dismissive avoidant when we met. I was still at least partially fearful avoidant. And it was cool because I got to take all this deep work I had done on myself and kind of apply it to like outwardly, like how to communicate in a relationship, not just how to work through my own stuff. And yeah, and that actually, I was already working in private practice with clients at that point. And that really led me to take a bit of a detour and start working with people more in relationships after that, because it was so eye-opening.
So many questions. I'm wondering if we should briefly define the four types just so we have a foundation, so then I can dive into questions from there. And actually maybe one quick question, because we're going to go through these four different types. And I guess it's probably a biased population, because when you have clients, well, maybe not, because I can tell you what my attachment style is. Are people pretty evenly the different types? Is one more than the other? And also, is everybody just one type? Can they be blends of types? What's the population look like?
Yeah. So the most in-depth research shows about 50% of the population is securely attached. And there's about 20 to 22% of dismissive avoidant attachment style and anxious attachment style that make up the other part of that split, with around 5 to 8% as the fearful avoidant or disorganized attachment style. So that's what a lot of the research shows. More recent research, it's done on sort of like large scale Gallup polls, which obviously has its downsides because it's like a lot of self-reporting. You know, a lot of that research shows that the securely attached population is trending downwards pretty rapidly, which is interesting too, because it does seem to correlate with some of the divorce rates. Like divorce rates are sort of trending towards 60%, and securely attached individuals are seeming to trend towards 40%. And I'm not saying that if you're not securely attached, you can't have a marriage that lasts, but it just, there's some interesting correlations there for sure. And then, you know, when it comes to the actual, can we have a blend of attachment styles? Yeah, everybody has like a major attachment style that's going to show up the most in your romantic relationships. But I don't like to think of attachment styles as being this like diagnosis, right? It's not like a personality disorder. The way I like to think of it is the subconscious set of patterns that impact how you relate to other people in relationships. And often those patterns come from your childhood, right? Like however you learned how to love will create the way that you try to love other people as an adult, including how you try to love yourself, you know, your relationship to your own boundaries, how you treat your own needs, how you treat your own emotions, and of course, how you treat that of others. And so we'll often have what I call our primary attachment style, but we can kind of lean in a different direction. So for example, somebody could be secure, but they could have like a secondary anxious attachment style where they do have some pretty relevant anxious patterns that they may want to work through. Somebody could be fearful avoidance, which is the very hot and cold attachment style in relationships, but they could trend more to their anxious rather than their avoidance side. So I like to think of us, we have a primary attachment style that impacts us the most by far. And then we have some secondary tendencies in a different direction. Not everybody, but that is something that tends to be quite relevant for people.
And actually, one quick question there as well, because in the book, you talk about these strange situation experiments, which helped or started, I think, the work in the beginning. Was that like the main experiment there?
Yeah. So do you mean to tell you about that for just a second?
Yeah. Yeah. Because my question about it is, it sounds like at least with kids, you can pretty quickly identify these attachment styles just based on how these kids act in these situations. I guess my question is how quickly can you identify these based on behaviors?
As children or as adults or both?
The experiment, it was kids, right? Infants, or what happened there?
Yeah. So this is an experiment. So a traditional attachment theory came out of Cambridge University with John Bowlby, and then later a psychologist named Mary Ainsworth. And basically they had this experiment to be able to determine what somebody's attachment style was at a very young age. And how they conducted this is they would have the parent and the child go into a room that sort of looked like a doctor's office waiting room. And they would then have the parent leave the room just briefly and have a stranger come into the room and be there in the same room as a child. And they would basically study and you know, witness how the child would react to A, the parent leaving, and B, the stranger coming in, and then C, how the parent would react to, or how the child would react to their own parent when the parent returned to the room. And what they found was really interesting. So they found that with securely attached individuals, they remained pretty emotionally stable, maybe expressed a little bit of discomfort when the parent left and when the stranger came in. But when the parent returned, they would reapproach that parent in a healthy way, be excited to be around them, but, you know, go back to playing, doing their own thing. They were pretty emotionally stable throughout the reaction, throughout the situation, compared to the reactions of the other attachment styles. Anxiously attached individuals, children became very anxious when the parent left, And when the parent returned, they would just cling to the parent like crazy, really cling, clearly like we're anxious, worried that the parent was going to leave again. And dismissive avoidant attachment styles, what they would do as children is when the parent would come back into the room, they would avoid the parent. So when the parent would make a bid for connection and try to get close to the child or interact with the child would look away. And so what you could actually visibly see is that this individual was minimizing, this child was minimizing their attachment needs with the parent as a strategy to protect themselves, to feel safe, because they felt, you know, obviously hurt that the parent had left them there. Fearful avoidance or disorganized, they were extremely ambivalent. So they would be hot and cold. They would go towards the parent. And then when the parent would get close, they'd sort of pull away. They were very colicky, very fussy. And they took a very long time to re-emotionally stabilize. And it's interesting because the fearful avoidant attachment style, you know, while the anxious attachment's main way of meeting their attachment needs or attachment strategy is to try to cling and get close, and the dismissive avoidant attachment style's main strategy is to push people away and minimize their attachment needs to others to feel safe, the fearful avoidance major attachment strategy is hypervigilance. They read between the lines. They go back and forth. They're hot and cold and in and out, and they're testing and they're trying to sort of figure out what they can, you know, take away from a situation because there's a lot of chaos and they don't trust their caregivers fully. So they want closeness, but they're scared of it at the same time. And that really manifests as a lot of ambivalence in their behavior. And so you could actually observe all of these things between the ages of 0 to 2 years old, which is absolutely wild. And then of course, because our attachment style affects our adult romantic relationships, but all relationships, friendships, family, co-working relationships, because it affects all of those different facets of life, then you can also view a lot of these patterns all the way into somebody's adult life, just manifesting in slightly different forms.
Wow. So if you can start observing it at 0, that means these patterns develop pretty rapidly once the baby is born?
Very rapidly, yeah. And a lot of it has to do with some crucial ingredients at the beginning. So early on, the thing that creates secure attachment more than anything else, and it's a small thing, but it has such a big impact, is a caregiver approach oriented and are they attuned? So, you know, what approach oriented means in psychology is you know, when the parent's around the child and the child is fussy or upset, you know, maybe they're hungry or maybe they need their diaper changed. If a parent is really attuned, then they're going to notice very quickly. And then they're going to be approach oriented, meaning they're going to actually go towards the child and make an attempt to co-regulate with them, to soothe them. And it sounds small, but what that does is it teaches a child a whole bunch of things. It conditions them very early on that it's safe to express negative emotion. My negative emotions are still worthy of love. I can trust other people. I can rely on them to try to meet my needs and show up for me. And so there's a lot of safety that develops around connection and belief around connection and positive emotional associations conditioned into the subconscious mind about relying on others, trusting I'm worthy of my needs being met by other people. It's okay to be vulnerable. But if those things are missing, you know, in the experience of the anxious attachment style, sometimes that's there, but a lot of times it's not there consistently, which leads to a feeling of perceived abandonment in a child. Like you may have really loving caregivers, but if they're working a lot or if they travel for work for months at a time, one of the parents, you know, that can create this abandonment dynamic for a child. And they feel like, okay, love is there, but love is taken away. So it's unpredictable. Is it going to come? Is it going to go? And that inconsistency creates this deep need to attach very strongly to the parent as a means of trying to maintain proximity and prevent feeling like they're going to be abandoned again. And so that's, you know, what forms that anxious attachment style. With the dismissive avoidant, there's generally a huge lack of attunement with the parents or caregivers, which essentially causes them to feel like, okay, I can't get my needs met. You know, maybe it's things like the diapers not being changed for very long periods of time on a regular basis, or when they cry, there's a lot of sleep training. Just put the child in the other room. There's now a lot of studies showing that that actually can lay some of the foundations for creating dismissive avoidant attachment style. And so anyways, there's all these different dynamics in here, but the fearful avoidant will have chaos at a young age. So if their parent is extremely dysregulated all the time, if their parent's using alcohol or substances, if they see a lot of fighting at a young age, they learn to associate the parent with a sense of comfort, but also with a sense of fear. And it causes them to feel very split in what they are thinking and feeling and experiencing with that parent, which obviously causes a lot of that hypervigilance and walking on eggshells all the way later into adult life.
I'm so glad you mentioned the sleep piece, because I was going to ask that. I personally don't have kids, and so I'm not like religiously following parenting information all the time. But I feel like the one argument I do hear discussed a lot is the sleep training thing and do you let the kids cry or not? And I was just thinking, you know, what are the effects of letting the kid cry while sleeping? And so you're saying it is showing now more that that might create an issue with attachment styles.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so interesting because a lot of the early research showed, oh, you know, it's important and you have to let the child learn to self-soothe and all these different things. But a lot more of the more recent research over the past 10, 20 years even is like, absolutely not. That creates dismissive avoidant attachment styles. It creates individuals that learn to repress their emotions. They go into their adult lives self-numbing, not self-soothing. And there's a big and crucial difference. And that sleep training has a lot more detrimental effects than it does upsides. And there's a whole discussion about what do you do instead? Like, obviously you don't let the child sleep in your bed for the rest of your life. It's a lot of what we call exposure work. So instead it's like slowly, you know, for example, you don't just decide, okay, the child's turned a certain age and now I'm just going to put them in the other room all the way down the hallway in our house, in a crib, and they just have to deal with it and try to sleep through the night. No, instead it's, you know, incremental exposure to letting that child learn to self-soothe. So for example, you know, for the first month, you may take the child out of the bed if you were sleeping with the child in your bed and put them in a crib 2 feet away from the bed and let them get used to having their own kind of space and domain. And then when they are stressed or if they do cry during the night, you know, giving them a little bit more time to try to self-soothe, but coming there and also showing that you're there. And then, you know, when the child gets a little more comfortable in the crib after a month or so, okay, now we're going to put the crib further away in the bedroom, at the other end of the bedroom. And then, you know, still be there for the child, get up, but also give the child more and more time to learn to soothe on their own. And so basically the incrementalism allows that child to develop this sense of self and connection to their own emotions and ability to self-regulate and self-soothe, but it's not mutually exclusive to the parent also being there to support the child. And so in that particular case, you know, if you just imagine the child's put down at the end of the hall and for 8 hours, they're left there to soothe on their own. I mean, that just creates a lot of negative downsides where it's not really about self-soothing. It's that child's often traumatized by that experience, especially when it's so intense so early. And yeah, it's such an interesting topic. We could talk about that just on its own forever, but that's some of the more recent research at a high level.
Sort of related to it, because there's the role of presumably in this situation, like the mom taking care of the baby. In families with multiple children, are there patterns with attachment styles and birth order? I'm just wondering if, you know, when the mom has the first kid, if they tend to be more stressed about being attuned to their child versus later down the line.
I love this question. I love, obviously you love to go deep on things. So I actually researched so much about this because I was so interested in this as well. And there's actually not really anything conclusive that shows that there's a huge impact on birth order and attachment style. Now, the reason is your attachment style is about the firing and wiring you get, right? That's, think of your attachment style as being the conditioning of patterns that you're exposed to repeatedly. And the thing that's so interesting about this, because there's some research kind of indicating, but there's a lot more that disproves that that's not, there's not really a strong relationship there. And so, you know, everything's sort of up in the air on it. And the reason being, in my opinion, is because you have so many different events that take place. So for example, you could have two parents who are securely attached, and for their first, you know, child that comes along, they're really present. But then we could see, you know, 6 years later, there's a second child. And in between the first and second child, you know, one of the parents, you know, developed a substance disorder or substance use disorder or became an alcoholic or lost their own parents. And when that second child was born, they just happened to be in deep grieving. Let's say there's infidelity in the relationship between two parents who showed up pretty securely with their first child. Well, now there's a divorce and there's chaos for the second child. So because there's so many like variables externally that will change and shift not only how the parents respond to the child, but how the child actually learns to respond to the parents, there's so many pieces that play in there. And it's often why you'll see that individuals, especially when there's a little bit of a gap in age, they can come from the same family but have different attachment styles, because in those early years, the circumstances can be so different.
Hey friends, I am about to tell you how to get 10% off the ideal coffee when it comes to supporting your health.
So if you guys know me, you know I am obsessed with optimizing basically everything I consume, and that especially relates to coffee. Did you know that coffee is one of the most powerful sources of antioxidants in the modern diet? And yet, not all coffee is created equal. Between sourcing, farming practices, roasting, and contaminants, there can be a huge difference in the health impact of the coffee that you drink. That is exactly why I created Glow Coffee. Glow Coffee is a premium, specialty-grade Arabica coffee sourced from sustainable women-led farms in Colombia. It's organically grown, and we third-party test it meticulously, like every single lot, for purity. And what makes Glow especially exciting from a biohacking perspective is that we specifically made it to be rich in chlorogenic acid, or CGA. That's one of coffee's primary, most potent antioxidant compounds that has been studied for its role in metabolic health, inflammation, oxidative stress, and so much more. The elevation levels of the beans, how they're grown, and how they're roasted all affect CGA levels. So we searched high and low to find the perfect beans naturally high in CGA and tested them to confirm that, and then we roast those beans to preserve the CGA content. And then test after that as well. Coffee is already one of the potentially biggest contributors of antioxidants in the human diet, so I designed Glow Coffee to maximize those benefits while keeping it incredibly clean and high quality. And this coffee is so clean. It's grown organically, of course, but then we go even farther than that. We third-party test the beans for almost 100 toxic compounds, including pesticides, heavy metals, and mold. Oh, and perhaps the best part is it is absolutely delicious. We're talking smooth, low bitterness. It's honestly the exact coffee I personally want to drink every single day of my life. It's so bright, smooth, and delicious that it's also perfect black for fasting. No added sweeteners or cream needed. You can also splash it on your face for an antioxidant-rich toner. I do that every single day. After the sauna, after the shower, all the things. I created Glow Coffee because it's really about upgrading one of our most common daily habits into something that truly supports your health and performance. You can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. That's 10% off Glow Coffee with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. Are you ready to glow inside and out? Fuel your day, illuminate your way. That's glowcoffeeco.com.
So in my family, I have two siblings. There's a 3-year difference between me and my sister, and then my brother and sister are like a year apart, I think.
And the two of them are older?
No, I'm the oldest.
Okay, yeah.
The timing of reading this book was so amazing because my sister, whose listeners might know this because I'm posting with her all the time, we're like best friends. She was going through some boy stuff. She's almost, I hope she doesn't mind me saying this on the air, she's almost like a caricature, I can't say the word, like the most extreme version of fearful avoidant, like in the way she acts in relationships. Like it's really profound to watch. And at the same time, she's very much kind of sounds like what your history was, where you identified these patterns in yourself and you really were, you know, trying to find answers and like change them. So she's very self-aware, really incredible, like wonderful human being. So the timing of me reading this book, I was reading it and like watching things she was doing in this relationship she was in. And I was like, it's like, Danielle, you got to read this book. It's going to explain so much, because she kept me like, I don't know why I'm doing this. Like, what's interesting though, it's going back to the different types in the family. So to answer your question before the podcast, I am a secure attachment style. And what's funny is I didn't want, because like, I think most people would want to be secure. I was so worried that I was maybe like lying to myself with the answers on the quizzes. So I took your quiz and then I went and found like 4 other quizzes online, like took all of them. I was like, I need to make sure that this is correct. But they all came back with secure. I think I'm secure with maybe, I can see a little bit of the anxious tendencies in some of the things I do. But I do think in general, I really identify with the secure. What's interesting though is like my memory of my childhood is so rosy. Like I don't really remember any trauma. It's funny. I interviewed Gabor Mate on the show, which was so amazing. And he thinks everybody has childhood trauma, which is probably true. But I remember at that point, I was like, I don't feel like I have childhood trauma. My brother and sister, though, apparently they had a completely, even in those 3 years, and my parents are wonderful, but they had certain experiences that I think led to different attachment styles. And we've had this epiphany recently where like, we just feel like we had completely different childhoods and that it led to these different types in us. I don't even know if there was a question there.
No, but you're absolutely correct. And you know, just I wanted to, if it's okay, just comment on something you said earlier because it was so interesting. So you said Dr. Matt Gavarmati says, oh, you know, like everybody has childhood trauma. Everyone does have childhood trauma, but there's a big difference between like small T trauma and big T trauma. Like you could make the argument that conditioning is traumatic, right? When we get punished for doing things wrong and rewarded for doing things right because we need to be socialized into society. Like all of those things have an impact, but it's really about like what the ratio is of healthy, secure behaviors versus trauma. Because if you have a little bit of trauma here and there, or you get into an argument with your parents here and there, and you can't properly emotionally process some things, everybody's got stuff they go through. But if that's really, you know, drowned out by how much approach-oriented behavior there is, how much attunement there is from parents, you know, parents teaching boundaries, wanting to help work through, you know, you learning your needs and show up for you and support you, then it's okay that there's imperfect moments in childhood. In fact, those can grow us, right? Those can give us opportunities to become more resilient or empathetic. But it's really that like ratio. If you're seeing that there's a pretty intense split between good and bad things, then you're going to see that that is creating that patterning, right? Because we get programmed or conditioned through repetition and emotion. So the more repetitive positive experiences we have, that works in our favor. The more repetitive, painful or traumatic experiences we have, that's obviously going to work in the direction of more insecure attachment.
That completely makes sense. And so it's so interesting to me that just, I guess, in those 3 years, environmentally and the social dynamics, things could have changed enough to where that repetitive experience was, you know, so different from my brother and sister compared to me. Like I said, I was reading the book, I was talking to her, and I was telling her, I was like, I don't know how to, 'cause she kept asking me how I was perceiving the world the way I was perceiving it. And the, you know, the way it, 'cause she was like kind of looking up to the way I was approaching relationships. And I was like, I don't know how to like tell you how to do this because it's literally just how I feel. Like, you know, like you either feel this or you don't. So that's why I really love in your book, you actually have a, you know, a program to actually make changes here. So that's one question to start with is if people don't do quote work on themselves, do their attachment styles tend to change? Do they tend to stay the same? And also how much agency do we have in changing if we're an insecure attachment style becoming more secure?
Yeah, great questions. So the first thing is, yes, our attachment style can change over time, but it's going to be according to our experiences themselves. So the subconscious mind is really like our habituated self, our programmed, conditioned, patterned self. And if we, you know, obtain a lot of our patterns from early childhood where there's, let's say, for example, a complete lack of attunement, well, then a lot of what's going to happen is you're going to learn, okay, well, I can't trust that people are here and that they're, that I can rely on them. So I have to become hyper independent to meet my own needs. And then you're more likely to see somebody be a dismissive, avoidant attachment style. Now, in theory, if, you know, we've got all that programming and now somebody's wired this way, right? They're conditioned to cope in this way, to try to love and relate to other people through this lens of, I can't get too close. I have to be hyper independent. If something was going to change someone's attachment style, it would have to be a lot in the other direction, because as a bare minimum, the subconscious mind takes at least 21 days to fire and wire new neural pathways that are strong enough that they'll stay solid and that they're actually going to create new sets of wiring, new ways that we perceive things, new patterns that we have, new habits in terms of how we show up or behave. And so, you know, what you would have to see, for example, is maybe there's, you know, a child who's dismissive avoidant, but then around that child's, you know, fifth birthday, both of their parents embark on a deep healing journey towards more emotional literacy and self-awareness. And suddenly from 5 years old until 18 years old, that child grows up in a household where they have very attuned parents who are very emotionally literate, because what that would happen, what that would create is repetition and emotion of all these new interactions that would recondition that program, right? That original program of dismissive, avoidant attachment style. Now, you can see it go in the other direction. You can see somebody securely attached, parents split up at 10 years old, extremely, you know, traumatic split, you know, all kinds of things go down, and that could create, you know, an anxious attachment style or even a fearful, avoidant attachment style. So things can change that if we have enough repeated repetition and emotion, it can refire and wire new neural networks, new neural pathways, and create new patterns within an individual in terms of how they view connection and relationships and how they learn to love. But it's less likely because we've got a lot of that wiring that's already there. And once we have that original foundation of how we show up, a lot of times we're going to use those coping mechanisms to navigate painful events as well, right? So if you see, for example, somebody's already a dismissive avoidant, then there's a bad divorce, they're probably going to keep more distance from that, right? So that's going to, often those pathways reinforce themselves. So it can happen. It's less likely. In fact, the vast majority of time our attachment style does stay the same, but it, you know, we could look at roughly 10% of the time, external factors can change our style for us. But the cool part is that because we do have neuroplasticity, because we can actually change our attachment patterns, when we consciously understand how this works, the conscious mind can rewire the subconscious mind. So we can reverse engineer what securely attached individuals have and their patterns to become secure within the relationship to ourselves. And of course, that affects our relationships to everybody else around us. This is the work that I've done on myself very, very successfully and have done with, you know, over 40,000 students who have been through our programs. 88.7% of people in self-paced programs became securely attached. And that's, you can't even determine if people showed up and did all the work or finished them. So it's a really, we're really happy with that stat versus the completion rate. So, you know, there's a tremendous amount of replicatable evidence that shows we can absolutely change our attachment style quite easily, but it does require consistency. It does require rewiring, and it does require that we understand the tools and the main pillars of how, like what it takes to actually become securely attached.
What is the role of repetition a lot in maybe duration, but maybe not as intense emotion versus less duration, but high emotion? And what I'm thinking of is, you know, being raised in a situation, maybe not super horrible for insecure attachment style, but leaning towards that way, but being in that situation for a long time versus, you know, one thing happening. And I'm just thinking for me, so with this secure attachment style, I did have a relationship a few years ago now. The other person, he was definitely, look, now that I think about it, a dismissive avoidant. Things happen that were really traumatic. Well, I don't know if I'm using that word too casually, really impacted me. And I think created a tendency for some insecure attachment styles. And that was just from basically, you know, a few things that he did in a very brief amount of time. But I was able to really recognize it as something that, because I had gone so long not having that insecure attachment piece in me. And then when it popped up after that relationship, I was really able to see it and be like, oh, this is from that. We're not going to like keep doing this. My question there is, you know, the difference between being in repetition and emotion, duration versus intensity.
You're asking such good questions. I'm so impressed. Okay, so to your point, and this is like really in the nuances of things and something I talk about when people are like deep into our program. So it's cool that you're able to pull this out already. So repetition and emotion is how we fire and wire, but if something is intensely emotional enough, it can create immediate program. So we call this like immediate imprinting. And what happens is if you can imagine, for example, and some of these are really relatable, somebody could never have an I am unsafe core wound. They could grow up in a safe household, safe life, all these things, and then be in a traumatic event like an earthquake and the building collapses. And obviously this is like an extreme example, but you know, they could walk away from that event constantly going around wondering like, is something bad going to happen? And they could have this immediate I am unsafe core wound because the intensity of the emotion of how unsafe they felt in that one traumatic experience of the earthquake, and maybe they saw people pass away around them. If something is intensely emotional enough, it can immediately imprint the subconscious mind.
That's what happened to me for sure. I'm realizing this is so interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And it's such a good question. It's so such an insightful question. And so, you know, there's ways to reverse engineer that. How can we have a lot of positive emotion, you know, on the other side of things to more rapidly imprint our subconscious mind with patterns we do want, with programming we do actually want to see in our lives. And I'm happy to sort of go more into that with some tools later on. But if something is repeated and emotional throughout our life, it's going to create a lot of patterns. So if somebody grows up in a household where their entire early childhood is all like them in a situation where they're always made to feel not good enough, their parents are always inconsistent and they fear abandonment, you know, somebody's really likely to have a strong anxious attachment style because that was repeated and made them feel emotional. But you could actually hold that next to a child who's fully in a secure household and then, you know, when they're 12 years old or 10 years old, the parent, one of their primary caregiver, the main parent who's around the most, dies, right? And not to use such like, you know, painful, scary examples to people, but if that were to happen, there's going to be such a strong abandonment wound there because that child is losing a caregiver they were so attached to that there's going to be some work to do later on in terms of, you know, anxious attachment style, the abandonment core wound, feeling alone. And, you know, that's just the nature of something so profound happening to us and how it can actually imprint us more immediately.
It's so interesting because, you know, just this abandonment concept, and you talk in the book about how we have three innate biologically wired fears, which I think if somebody had asked me that, like, what are the three innate biologically wired fears? I don't think I would have guessed. But you said it was falling, loud noises, and abandonment. So interesting. And now I'm just thinking, like I mentioned with that relationship, it just really goes to show how powerful the abandonment thing is. Because long story short, what happened, one of the things that happened was I just got abruptly abandoned by this romantic partner with no warning and didn't know. And what was interesting about it is after that, so like before that, if I were texting people, if they didn't answer for a little bit, I didn't think twice about it. And then that happened. And then I started overanalyzing. If somebody didn't answer, I was like, oh, I said something to like offend them and they've abandoned me. And then the moment I realized that like, this has got to stop. And this was definitely from that was when I remember I like texted my mom who like, I would never think twice about if she answers or doesn't. And she like didn't answer like right away. And I was like worried she was offended. And I was like, oh, okay, this is all from this one event. And it just goes to show, it's just fascinating how powerful that abandonment fear is in us humans. Another question related to the abandonment, because it's this idea of, you know, being alone. And you've mentioned a lot throughout this conversation, the word, you know, independence. I'm super fascinated and curious about the difference between wanting independence, being independent versus being, you know, a dismissive person versus being interdependent. I personally identify as being very independent. Like I feel like I'm really good on my own. I don't really ever feel lonely. Like I really don't. And my mom has always said that I don't know, that I've like marched to the beat of my own drummer. Like I really identify as an independent person, but I don't like, so how does that compare to being a dismissive person who seeks independence?
Great question. Yeah. And sorry to hear about that with your past relationship, but to your point too, when you mentioned that, like, because you were able to witness that, because you had such a clear picture of like not feeling that before and that not being a huge wound for you, because there's a difference between something being a fear and a wound, right? Like as a baby, we're wired, our species is particularly dependent on its caregivers for a long time as human beings, more so than like most other species on the planet. So there's this like fear of abandonment that if a caregiver goes away, you know, oh my gosh, will we survive without them? But that doesn't have to become a wound. The wound is when we have trauma around it. And then we project it onto everything. I always tell people our core wounds are kind of like, if you can imagine, you know, walking into the woods and you see a bear and you run away and you're chased by the bear and you're safe. But then the next day you have to go back through the same path in the woods. Well, your mind stored the threat really strongly of the bear from the day before, and it reprojects it out onto everything. So now it goes, where's the bear? Where's the bear? Where's the bear? And it looks for it everywhere. And that's really how our core wounds work. If we have a wound around abandonment where we're actually abandoned, or there's a lot of like inconsistency that makes us feel kind of abandoned and alone growing up, then you're going to have wounds there and you're going to project them onto everything all the time. You're going to be like, oh my gosh, somebody didn't text me back, and that's going to come up. So for you, because you have such a secure background, you know, you had something to compare it to, but for a lot of people, they don't have something to compare it to. It's all they know. And so it feels so confusing for people to reprogram, because they're like, wait, what is it like to live without this? So, and also probably because you're, you know, on your journey and dig into things and research. And so I think that probably is so helpful and supportive there too. So anyways, I just thought that was such an interesting thing that you raised. But to go back to interdependence versus dismissive avoidant, another fantastic question is, if you look in polarities, so let's say you look at it through like the lens of the extremes first, because I think it kind of paints a picture for people who are less familiar. At one end of the extreme, you have codependency. And you can sort of think of codependency as being, we get into a relationship, I'm going to meet all of your needs, you're going to meet all of my needs. We're never really going to like have to communicate what our needs are or really know ourselves. We're just going to like do everything for each other. And independence, too much independence, when it becomes extreme, is actually called counterdependence. And counterdependence is like, I'm just going to meet all my own needs. You're just going to meet all your own needs. And, you know, we'll come together a little bit for a little bit of like high level interaction, but that's kind of it. Interdependence is I can meet my own needs and I can self-soothe and I can rely on myself and find, you know, who I truly am and what my hobbies and interests are. And I know myself and I can show up for myself. And I am also not at all afraid to communicate to other people if I need something from them. If I had a bad day at work and I need advice, or if I need some support from a family member as I have my first child, or as I, you know, like those ways where we are unafraid to reach out, to connect, to lean on others, to ask for support. So we have both sides to us, and they're not mutually exclusive. And that's interdependence. And independence, you could be an independent person as sort of a characteristic or personality trait, but still have access to interdependence in the way that you relate to people. They don't have to be like, because you could be independent, but you could also be somebody who can lean on people and isn't afraid to share your needs and make requests and also allow other people to lean on you, because that's also an important part of interdependency. But I would almost like differentiate, if it makes sense, independence from counterdependency being two different things. A dismissive avoidant is counterdependent. When people start leaning on them too much or making requests to them, they get really, you know, cold feet. And they also have a really hard time ever trying to open up and lean on other people or connect to other people. And so, you know, and really share their emotions with other people and ask for support. And so that makes them counterdependent because they struggle there. And independence is like, oh, I know who I am and I can kind of do my own thing and I'm comfortable on my own.
That also reminds me of the section on boundaries, because this idea of how we are relating to other people and putting up boundaries and how we relate to them. I'm super curious, how do we know if the boundaries we are implementing are healthy or not? I had a big epiphany in the section on the fearful avoidant where it was talk. I think it was the fearful avoidant where it was saying they can implement boundaries, like they think they're being good at implementing boundaries, but they're actually like not, and they're like hot and cold in them. And I was thinking how this explains some mentioned my sister, some things with her. So this concept of boundaries, how can we know what, if we're being healthy and how we implement them?
Yeah, it's such a good question. So the point you're mentioning, and I laughed because it was like, it's such a common theme for fearful avoidance. What they do is, and this is me, honestly, at one point, like I did a lot of work on this myself, where I, you know, if people were like, oh, are you good at setting boundaries? I'd be like, yes, I know how to tell people what I feel about them and what I think when they're violating my boundaries. But, you know, I would do it from anger. And, you know, in order to get angry, a lot of things have to go wrong first. And so, you know, what I realized is like, oh, if you're setting boundaries from anger, you're just using anger as a boundary. You're not actually like communicating what the boundary is in real time. And probably you had to have a lot of boundary violations that led you to get angry to the point where you then express in an unhealthy way. And so, you know, what often happens is fearful avoidance will be boundaryless until they get, you know, upset enough, and then they'll become extreme with their boundaries from anger. And unfortunately, then people don't really hear your boundaries. They just hear that you're angry at them and they get defensive, and then you're in an argument and then your boundary got lost in the mix. Or, you know, anxious attachment styles, they're generally just profoundly boundaryless on an ongoing basis. And dismissive avoidance, because they're counterdependent, they don't really ever make healthy boundary compromises. They're just always setting extreme boundaries and never being able to communicate nuanced boundaries. And so when it comes to boundaries, you know they're healthy because A, you've had the ability to consider yourself equally to the other person. So much of learning how to set healthy boundaries is to take yourself into consideration. If you see yourself operating in extremes, you probably weren't. So, you know, let's say as an example that my neighbor comes over and says, Thais, I need you to help me clean my whole house all day Sunday. And I know Sunday's my one day off each week. You know, I may really like my neighbor. I may really want to support them and help them, but I'm going to take myself into consideration, right? I'm going to look and sort of be able to attune to myself and think about my schedule for a moment and say, you know what? It's my only day off and I'm not going to be able to come spend the whole day cleaning your house and helping you, but I'll come by and bring some breakfast and help out for half an hour or 45 minutes in the morning and bring some breakfast so you don't have to cook. And, you know, there's the ability to like think about, is it a yes or a no for me? Okay, their request for me was a no, I'm not going to help all day. Well, what can I do? Is there something I can do that feels good for me? And what that allows is it allows somebody to actually take into consideration their own truth and still move from a place of contribution. So a boundary in one sense is, you know, if somebody's asking you for something, it's your yeses and nos. A boundary also is if somebody does something, can we actually communicate, hey, that was a boundary violation. Maybe you're in a work meeting with somebody and you know, somebody communicates in a way that you find to be like disrespectful. You know, you may take that person, or you know, after the work meeting and say, hey, you may not have meant anything by it, but for me, you know, when that comment was made, it's not acceptable to speak to me that way. It can't happen again. And I just want to let you know. And, you know, the art of setting boundaries in a healthy way is A, we consider ourselves and we're able to check in with ourselves. B, we can recognize what we need to happen instead. And C, we are able to use strong language in a very calm tone. So that's really the art of a healthy boundary, being able to say, hey, this is unacceptable, that can't happen again, but say it like how I'm saying it, not say, this is unacceptable, this can't happen ever again. Because then we just get into an argument. And when, as soon as you're arguing, nobody's listening to what the boundary was. So those are some like sort of pointers for boundaries, but you'll know that a boundary is correct in your life if you're making it from truth instead of from fear. And if you are in a place where you're like, I have to just say no to this person who asked me out on a date because I'm afraid of dating and being rejected, well, you just set a boundary from fear. That wasn't actually something that's benefiting your life. You should work through the rejection fear and then go on, you know, different dates. But if you have somebody ask you on a date and somebody, you're like, you know what, I really only see them as a friend and I'm not interested in them and they keep texting me and reaching out, I may set a boundary and say, hey, I only see you as a friend and, you know, I don't want this to proceed any further. And then you would set a boundary from that place of truth, checking in with yourself, attuning to yourself, knowing what your true yeses and nos are, and then being able to proceed from there.
Hi, friends. Would you like to have the most epic eating experience? I'm talking eradicate bloating and better absorb your nutrients. If so, you need digestive enzymes. These are one of my most favorite supplements out of everything I take, and I truly cannot imagine my life without them. Digestive enzymes are key to break down your food into usable nutrition and to stop things like bloating, digestive distress, constipation, all the things. That's why I created Avalon X Digest, and you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us. You can also get a subscription and save 15%, which you can pause or cancel at any time. Friends, I worked so hard to create the perfect blend of enzymes for Avalon X Digest. It's a full-spectrum plant-based enzyme blend with proteases to help you break down protein, amylase for carbs, lipase for fats, cellulase for fiber, and so much more. In fact, there are 13 different types of enzymes in this blend. I cannot tell you how many people have told me that when they take Avalon X Digest, they experience no digestive distress with meals. These are truly game changers. And for any of you guys looking to up your protein intake, Avalon X Digest will help you actually break down and assimilate your protein so you get more protein from your meals. I wanted to create the highest potency enzymes so that you get all of these benefits when you eat with no problematic fillers or ingredients. Avalon X Digest is also tested multiple times for purity and potency, comes in glass bottles, and is truly the best enzymes on the market. And again, you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us.
I love this so much. And like, I think for me, just analyzing how I interact with boundaries, I think I don't use the word intense, but I consciously implement boundaries early. So when I'm not like in an emotional state, like I'm very scheduled and everything. And so that's so that I know I can always show up to what I'm showing up to and that I won't, and hopefully get to the point of, you know, that anger or that emotional drain or something where I'm setting a boundary last minute, you know, in that other style.
From that reactive kind of space. Yeah.
But I do notice, like I'll notice in me, I think I lean towards the anxious attachment style with setting boundaries because I will have that thought like, oh, by doing this, you know, are they not going to like me? Or I typically can, you know, not follow through with that anxious style with not implementing it. A related question actually with needs. So this is actually a huge question for me because you talk in the book about how so much of what we do, and you know, including these boundaries, come from these needs that we have. Like everything is about meeting unmet needs. How much of needs relate to how do I phrase this? Relate to a not getting something or a sense of lack. So kind of like what we were talking about with, I mean, honestly, with this, with the insecure attachment styles and abandonment and things like that. So how much of trying to meet needs is from not getting a need that you need compared to, like, for me, I feel like some of my needs, because you have lists in the book. Oh, and I wanted to say for listeners really quickly, quick note about the boundaries. If listeners are really enjoying this, definitely get the book, because there's literally like step-by-step processes to address all of this. So like with boundaries, Thais will show you how to identify them, and there's like a boundary reframe chart and all the things. So just another plug for the book. So back to the needs, like you have all these lists of, you know, needs that people have, and there's a lot of like I am statements and things like that. I feel like for me, some of my needs actually didn't come from lack, but they came from being rewarded for certain things in childhood. Is that also a possibility? So like I am significant. Like I feel like that's a big need for me. And I think it's because I was always like the straight A student and like the high achiever. And I was really rewarded for that. And so now I like really need that. Like, yes. Where do needs come from?
It's a great question. So needs, we have basic human needs, but when you look at our conditioning and how it works, it's either through positive or negative emotional association. So the brain is wired to avoid pain and to seek pleasure. So absolutely, if you're in a situation where you get rewarded for things, then that's positively reinforcing. It's building in positive emotional associations to things, and then we'll hunger for more of that. And that can absolutely be a way that we establish needs. And in fact, almost to everything that you're saying, there's like such a clear thread. Like if you're securely attached, you're more likely to have needs that come from that space. Then we have needs that come from a profound lack. And when there's a profound lack, we could make an argument that we have wounds around our needs. And, you know, I almost like to think of it as an analogy where there's a big lack for something. We kind of have a hole in our bucket. Like if you imagine the need is like a bucket that needs to be filled. Well, if we are absolutely lacking something, you know, it's really hard to kind of satiate later on in life. So for example, you said like significance, right? So let's say, for example, you grow up, you get a lot of, you know, positive reinforcement when you, you know, achieve your straight A's and these sorts of things. Well, you're going to see as a result that when, you know, as you go throughout your life, you think, okay, well, I get love, I get connection when I do these things. So I'm going to do more of these things to get more of those positive feelings that I'm experiencing or positive moments I have with people around me. So that would be the healthy version. If somebody instead grew up in a dynamic where they were severely punished every time they didn't get a straight A, then, you know, in that particular case, they may actually have this wound around the need that's like, if I don't get a straight A, if I don't achieve, then I'm unsafe, you know, because the punishment is really severe, or then I'm not good enough. I'm unlovable if somebody instead just like withdraws from them and kind of gives them the silent treatment as a child. So we'll then, when we have wounds around our needs, it becomes this very fear-based relationship we have to these aspects of ourselves. So you may see, for example, somebody struggle with like almost OCD around perfectionism as an adult. If they were made to feel like I am unsafe if I don't achieve straight A's, they may be the individual that's terrified to make mistakes on a work project, terrified to take action because they're just so perfectionistic and so stuck on these small details. Because actually what's happening is they've been conditioned to think if I make a mistake, I'm going to be severely punished. I'm going to be unsafe. And now their relationship to how they show up to take action around their needs or their commitments is going to be coming from a place of woundedness and fear rather than from a place of, oh, this is meaningful to me and I like this. And so it's in my truth. And so, you know, when we have these wounds around our needs, it creates, unfortunately, a lot of dysfunction in how we take action. And sometimes even more so, can take us away from our authenticity. You know, sometimes somebody can really want to do something, but they're like, oh no, I'm going to fail, or I'm going to be punished, or I'm going to be unloved or judged or ridiculed. And then we don't move in the direction of our dreams or the things that are kind of calling us. And so there can be a lot of painful parts when our conditioning and a lot of the actions we take on a daily basis are coming from a place of fear of needs not being met or needs being taken away rather than truth.
And then one step further with meeting those needs, actually meeting them, it sounds so cliche. You say it a few times in the book and it sounds so cliche. And I also think it is so, so true. How can we not actually meet those needs from other people if we haven't met them ourselves? It sounds so cliche, but apparently it's true.
So here's the most interesting, well, there's a lot of interesting things about all the attachment style stuff, but here's something that to me always just stuck out as being so mind-blowing about our subconscious mind. So at the end of the day, your subconscious mind, it's survival oriented. It's survival wired. It sees, you know, familiarity as safety and thus survival. So your subconscious mind will keep going back to its comfort zone. It sees things as like familiar. And so then, you know, even if it's been painful, I'm surviving. So it's still working. So what ends up happening is if you look at the research into secure attachment styles, guess who secure attachment styles end up with? Other secure attachment styles, the vast majority of the time, because their subconscious comfort zone is the relationship they have to themselves. How we treat ourselves is the biggest subconscious comfort zone we have. So if you look at a secure person, they're generally quite good with their boundaries. They're generally quite good at communicating their needs. They're generally don't have a lot of core wounds. They're generally good at meeting their own needs. So they will be attracted to people and end up investing in people long-term who also honor their boundaries, want to meet their needs, want to communicate around conflict and solve problems. And if somebody isn't doing those things, the subconscious will be like, ooh, this is unfamiliar. This doesn't feel good. And it will reject them or want to move away from that person. Whereas, and it's not always the case, like, but as long as somebody's dominantly securely attached, they most often end up in those long-term relationships with dominantly securely attached people. And what's so interesting is that if you look at, like, as an example, an anxious attachment style, they end up, you know, because they're so busy people pleasing to try to avoid abandonment, they often end up dismissing and avoiding their own feelings and needs because they're so preoccupied with other people's and winning them over and getting approval. And so as a result, you know, anxiously attached individuals in their adult lives often seek people who treat them the way they treat themselves, just like we all do. And so they end up seeking people who will dismiss and avoid their needs, just like they dismiss and avoid their own needs. And so we end up like keeping these patterns alive. And now, Melanie, I totally forget your original question, but will you remind me of what it was?
This cliche that we have to meet our own needs before other people can meet them.
Okay. So how this then ends up, you know, actually creating this subconscious pattern is like if we are in a position in our own lives where we don't meet our own needs and we don't know how to self-soothe by doing that, then the moment that somebody mirrors that back to us, not only will it be uncomfortable and our subconscious mind will reject it because it's not a part of our comfort zone and then it won't be familiar and then it won't feel safe as a result, but you can truly imagine it's like a hole in the bucket. So let's just keep on that same example of the anxious attachment style. You know, they're so busy people pleasing other people and worrying that they're not good enough for others and putting everybody else on a pedestal that they put themselves down a lot. And so when somebody ends up in a relationship with an anxious attachment style and they validate them, they say, oh, I'm so attracted to you, or I love spending time with you. At first, if you can imagine like liquid going into the bucket to fill it up, like water getting poured into the bucket, wow, it feels so good. Like somebody's, you know, meeting this need, the bucket's getting filled up, but then there's a hole. And very quickly, soon after that water pours in, it leaks out. And, you know, the anxious attachment styles, you'll see this all the time. They'll end up in a situation where they have a conversation with somebody, somebody compliments them, and then they go back to, did they really mean it? Is there an ulterior motive? Will they really stick around? Do they tell everybody this? And if we are in a place where we are not validating in the relationship to self, when somebody's validating to us, we either constantly seek it and hunger for it because we have a hole in our bucket and, you know, we're always taking it away from ourselves, or our subconscious mind actively rejects it. It doesn't believe in it. It doesn't accept or receive the compliments or the needs being met because it's so unfamiliar to the subconscious mind that it has to reject it as a means to keep itself safe.
It's so fascinating because, like we said, it sounds such like it's like such a cliche, but it's literally what happens. One major question about all of this, because you were mentioning that secure people often end up with secure attachment styles and the different attachment styles that might end up together. So can any of the attachment styles work together, I guess, especially if they do self-work? I guess my question here is, so I'm like a secure attachment style. How much should these things be red flags where you don't engage in a relationship with another attachment style like this versus, you know, working through it?
I'll tell you something, and this is so true, and I say this a lot, and I think it's so important to vet for in a relationship is, you know, there's times, you know, there's obviously extremes where maybe somebody's like trying to get sober and they're just out of a 5-year relationship and they aren't, you know, they don't know how to be on their own. They're not sober. They've got all these extraneous like circumstances in their lives. There's a time and place where you're going to vet somebody and say, you know what, that person's not a good fit right now because they've got a lot going on. And that could also be extreme attachment trauma that they haven't worked on or worked through yet. And there's, you know, those sort of outlying events where you can tell that person's not in a healthy place to be able to do a relationship, and that person, you know, it's almost good for that person to have to focus on being on their own for a little bit and doing some healing and some inner work. But when I worked with clients, and I worked a ton, I would work with 40 people a week for quite a long time. I would always see people come in, and in the very early days of working with people, I would be like, oh, what's their attachment style and what are their wounds? And I would wonder these things. And then eventually I just realized it doesn't actually matter what their attachment style is. It mattered, are they both here and willing to do the work? And I think that that's the biggest thing to vet for, unless there's really intense extremes, right? Which are obvious. If somebody is just insecurely attached, you know, there can kind of be superpowers to that, right? Somebody can be really resilient, or somebody can be deeply empathetic or deeply caring. Like, there's some nice things. But for the maladaptive patterns, you know, the fears or the wounds or the codependency parts from the unmet needs, or, you know, the things that will come up and actually create problems in a relationship, really, it's okay from that perspective. Is the person working on them? Are they taking active action? And when we vet for people in dating, we never want to vet for their words. We want to vet by their actions. So somebody could say, oh yeah, I'd like to in the future learn about those. Oh yeah, I'd like to do the work. Yeah, I'm open to doing the work on myself, but are they doing it? Is it in their behaviors? Is it showing up? And I find that to be like one of the most important places to really dig into.
I've definitely had that experience where the other person says they're working on it and, you know, going to make all these changes. But if it just keeps happening, I feel like actions, yeah, speak louder than words.
Isn't it the truth though? It's so true.
There's just so much here. Was there anything else you wanted to draw attention to for listeners?
The one thing I would say that's just so important is core wounds. So I would say like the biggest thing, you know, because we have our needs, like so much of healing our attachment style and becoming secure is, you know, number one, we talked about needs. So learning your needs and how to meet them yourself, that helps you, you know, self-regulate and self-soothe. And you ask some great questions about that. So I feel like that's like super covered. Having healthy boundaries, absolutely huge. We talked about that. Learning to actually communicate your needs to other people and like share them vulnerably. And then the other two pillars that I just think are so important are learning to regulate your nervous system. So making sure you're not in like sympathetic nervous system mode all the time, like fight and flight mode, and then learning to reprogram your core wounds if you have them. So if you have all these core wounds that are like, I'm going to be abandoned or alone, or if you have these core wounds of I'm going to be trapped or helpless or powerless, or it's shameful to open up, I'm weak if I, you know, lean on other people. A lot of those core wounds are associated per attachment style. Like you can hear them, like the dismissive avoidant has a lot of the, you know, I'm going to be trapped in the wrong relationship, or I'm weak if I open up, and shameful. The anxious attachment styles have a lot of the, I'll be abandoned, alone, rejected, excluded, disliked. And those things end up as the biggest triggers in our relationships, biggest triggers in the relationship to ourselves. And it shows up with everybody. You were kind of touching on this earlier with like when your ex made you feel like that. And then you had that moment with your mom where you're like, wait, is she upset with me? What's going on? Is she pulling away? And, you know, when we have painful experiences, they imprint the subconscious mind and they can be rewired. That's, I guess, what I just wanted to stress is that they can be changed. And I'm happy to go into like a tool if you want to share with listeners or however you want to sort of move through it.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah. Like, so I'll share a tool then. So one of the things that's so important to recognize is like when we have a core wound, and let's just use the example that like the core wound is, I am not good enough. When we have a core wound, I am not good enough. Those are not conscious choices. Nobody's waking up and being like, I'm going to tell myself I'm not good enough all day and see how I feel. There's subconscious programs and they happen because of painful past events. And we talked about this earlier, like the bear in the forest. If you see the bear in the forest, you store the threat and then you project it out into everything. You're like, is the bear coming? Where is it? And your mind's just trying to protect you by doing that. But it creates a lot of dysfunction when it's like, I'm going to be abandoned, or I'm going to be betrayed, or I'm going to be trapped. And we constantly then like project that onto things. And you can imagine like, so you're secure. So I can, you know, guess that you probably showed up really well in that relationship. Like you probably wanted to work through challenges if they were there and be supportive of each other and like have healthy behaviors. And you probably showed up tremendously well. And, you know, God bless him, but he probably showed up where even though you were so amazing, he has these unresolved core wounds from childhood where he easily feels trapped, largely because he's not, you know, able to communicate his own needs or open up. And then maybe he feels like opening up would be shameful or defective. These are a lot of the core wounds of the dismissive avoidant. And so you may not see it because he may not be talking about it because these are his inward programs and he's not choosing them. He's not saying, I'm going to tell myself I'm trapped and see how I feel. But because he has these pre-existing subconscious wounds, like the bear in the woods, he projects them out onto everything. And then he worries, well, what if my feelings change in 10 years and then I'm trapped? Or what if I, you know, can't explain and get my needs met? And then it just becomes sabotage. Then he can take an amazing connection and relationship and sabotage it because his subconscious mind is perceiving things and threats where there may not even be any. And then when we perceive there's a threat, we have to fight or flight or freeze or fawn. And so then he goes into, you know, maybe pull away mode or sabotage mode. And of course, I'm like just speaking into, you know, I don't know all the details.
Hi, friends. Guess what? Have you ever wanted a dating app that takes into account your dietary preferences? Things like fasting, whether or not you're paleo, keto, vegan, omnivore, junk food lover, whatever it may be. Or maybe it's important to you that you date a fellow wine drinker or a coffee lover. Or you're sober curious and don't want drinks to be the first date. Speaking of first dates, did you know that the top 4 first dates all involve food or drink? That's right, food and drink are super important for compatibility. That's why I'm making a dating app to address this. It's basically like any other mainstream dating app, except you can filter by dietary preference. For all of the launch information, including how to get it and launch specials, get on the email list. For that, go to cravingdating.com. Again, that's cravingdating.com. Through that list, we'll be sending updates, information about the launch, and even let you guys weigh in on the development. So again, go now to cravingdating.com.
Oh, you're nailing it. You're nailing it. Like, exactly. Yep.
So then all of a sudden, we have these wounds that are like sabotaging our lives. And they don't just show up in our romantic relationships. They show up in our friendships. They show up in our familial relationships. They show up in our workplace relationships even. And we all have these behaviors for how we cope with when we feel those wounds. And a lot of times the behaviors are to, you know, flee something or to fight back too strongly, or, you know, we have these maladaptive coping mechanisms. So the core wounds that we have, you're not born with them. You're not born thinking that you're going to be trapped or that it's shameful to emote. You know, you're born emoting and thinking that that's normal. And so, you know, we can rewire those things because we have the understanding of neuroplasticity. And I often give people a starting tool for rewiring a core wound, because I just think it's like one of the most important things we can do. And there's three steps to the tool. It's first step is to find the core wound and its opposite. So for example, if it's, I am not good enough, I am good enough, pretty easy first step. The second step is we have to speak to our subconscious mind, because as we established, like, these are not conscious, we're not choosing these things or to think or feel this way. The subconscious mind doesn't speak language. You know, it's part of the reason why I'm not a believer in affirmations. Affirmations, they're just language. You're just speaking, you're using your conscious mind to speak to your conscious mind. And the way you'll know that your subconscious doesn't speak language is if I were to say to you, okay, Melanie, whatever you do, do not think of a pink elephant. Yeah, like there's the elephant. And so what happens is like your conscious mind understands do not, but your subconscious is like, whoop, image. And so, you know, when we do affirmations, we're like, I am good enough, I'm good enough, I'm good enough. Well, it's not really doing anything. It's your conscious mind just speaking to your conscious, but it's a subconscious mind issue that we have a core wound. So what language does the subconscious actually speak? Well, it speaks in emotions and images. So now we've established, okay, you know, for neuroplasticity, we need to fire and wire things to create new patterns. We need to fire and wire what? We need to fire and wire emotion and imagery, because that will speak to our subconscious. So now how do we do that? Well, every single memory we ever have is actually just a series. It's sort of a container for emotions and images. If I were to say, okay, you know, what's your favorite childhood memory? And it was playing at the park with your friends. You would see the images when you tell that old story or rehash that memory. You'd see the images of the slide and the playground and maybe of your friends. And you know, we've all seen when people tell old stories or old memories, they laugh or they smile or they cry, you know, depending on what emotions are in that memory. So now we've established that to speak to our subconscious mind, we can use memory. And we've also established that, okay, to rewire, we need repetition. So we need repetitive memories, because then we get the three ingredients. We get repetition, emotion, and imagery, and we get to repeatedly speak to our subconscious mind. So what we do in step two, so step one, what's your core wound and its opposite? I'm not good enough. I am good enough. Step two is we need 10 memories of times we actually did feel good enough. And when we have 10 memories, what we can do is we can look for small things. They don't have to have tons of emotion. We can be like, you know, I was a good enough friend yesterday to somebody who was in need that gave me a call and I showed up for them. I was a good enough partner 2 weeks ago when my partner was going through a hard time and I was there. I was a good enough, you know, worker in my job when I had that hard conversation with a coworker or a colleague and it went well, you know, so it can be small things. But what we're doing is we're getting actual tangible events because we can see them in our mind's eye. We can feel about them because there's emotion attached to them, even if it's a small bit of emotion, like a little bit of pride or a little bit of accomplishment. And then what we do is step three, after we come up with these 10 things to support the new idea instead of that old wound, I am good enough, not I'm not good enough. Step three is we record it somewhere. We record ourselves saying it into our phone, for example, or a computer or iPad. And when our brain is producing alpha brainwaves, which happens in the first morning or the first hour of the morning and last hour before you go to bed, when we're producing alpha brainwaves, it also happens after a meditation or intense exercise, we are more suggestible, meaning our subconscious mind is more open to being reprogrammed. So now we pull these three steps together. Step one, what is your core wound and its opposite? I'm not good enough. I am good enough. Step two, my 10 pieces of memory for when I actually did feel good enough about things that I did or how I showed up. And step three, I record this and listen back to it in that first hour that I wake up. So I'm most suggestible. And I do this for 21 days because research into neuroplasticity shows it takes 21 days of repetition to really deeply form neural pathways that are strong enough to stick. And that's where we get those new habits from. And across 21 days, it only takes like 2 or 3 minutes to listen back to what you've recorded and feel about it and see the images in your mind of those memories. And, you know, dropping a core wound, letting go of like this constant fear of being alone or excluded or rejected or abandoned or trapped or being seen as weak. I mean, these are things that like disrupt your life. They make you leave relationships too early. They make you push people away or hold on too close or sabotage your workplace projects. So like being able to let go of these core wounds is absolutely life-changing. And it takes 21 days of like 2 or 3 minutes a day.
That's so incredible. And so to clarify, because you're talking about the conscious mind talking to the conscious mind. So listening back is a catalyst to then envision it, right? To remember it.
Yes.
Okay. That's where the work, that's where the power is coming from. And then while in that alpha state.
Exactly. And it's listening back and like really seeing the images and then really feeling the emotion as much as you can. And that way we've got like, I am good enough because I did this and I'm remembering it and I'm seeing it and I'm feeling about it. And that's what's allowing us to really fire and wire at that subconscious level.
I love it. This is so amazing. So I think listeners can understand now why I'm obsessed and I want everybody to read this. Major question for you. Well, you have a free attachment style quiz that we can put a link in the show notes to. We'll put a link to your book. So can people enroll in your development school? Is it online?
Yeah, it's all online. It's definitely like where I do like all the work that I do now. I don't see clients one-to-one anymore, but what we do is basically people come into PDS and at the personal development school by your attachment style, there's like 6 major course recommendations. They're all like an hour and a half long. They're not too long. It's pretty easy. And it's your program to become securely attached. So we go through how to rewire your core wounds, how to learn what your needs are, how to communicate them healthily, how to reset your boundaries, how to meet your own needs for self-soothing and how to regulate your nervous system. And we go through these 5 major pillars for individuals, teach them how to do it, but specifically how to apply these tools at the subconscious level so they get patterned in, so they become like a part of your patterning, how you naturally show up. So you get this program. And then on top of that, we have a daily peer support group that people can jump into. We have a daily outside of the peer support group live webinar where you can come and ask personal questions. Like you get your one-to-one time in a group setting. I'm in there like 3 days a week. We have other counselors and coaches in there. And so, yeah, there's lots of support, but it's sort of like your attachment rewiring bootcamp.
Oh my goodness. And I just saw, so we have a code for listeners. Thank you. Oh my goodness. Okay. So listeners can use the code IF podcast to get 50% off the personal development school. Oh my goodness. Thank you so much. Listeners, sign up now. We will put links to all of this in the show notes. Oh, so how long, by the way, is the actual program?
It's a 90-day boot camp. So you go through and the goal is to like move through it all within 90 days. Some people are much quicker depending on like how long it's self-paced. So you can do it as quickly and or as slowly as you'd like, but that's like the goal that we put for everybody.
Awesome. The last question, I promise, this is the last question that I ask every single guest on the show. And it's just because I realize more and more each day how important mindset is. So what is something that you're grateful for?
I am so grateful. I feel like it sounds so cheesy because we just talked about this on the podcast, but I am actually so grateful that I've done this work myself because, you know, growing up, even like my family relationships were just things I struggled with so much. And I'm like, when I think of like what I'm grateful for, the first thing that comes to mind is like my husband, my parents, my sister. And that happened through a lot of work. It wasn't like an easy thing. That was really putting the work in. And yeah, I'm grateful that I've had the opportunity to build those relationships in a way that like is really fulfilling and really authentic. So yeah, that's what I would say.
Has your husband worked through his attachment style?
Oh yeah, yeah. We've been together for like 10 years he really showed up to do the work, honestly. And that was like a thing I was vetting for, is like, I'm going to be doing this as he, and he did an amazing job and he is the freaking best. Like, I think people get, you know, dismissive when such a hard time, and they are really hard when they're not doing the work for sure. But I've been lucky enough to see a lot of dismissive women show up and put that work in, my husband being one of them, of course. But then like, you know, I saw lots of clients over the years and they show up beautifully in the end. So it just matters. Like, are people doing the work or not?
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Thais. Literally, I enjoy this conversation so much. The work you're doing is profound, incredible. Listeners, sign up, get the book, sign up now for the Personal Development School. The coupon code IFPODCAST will get you 50% off. Thank you so much. Hopefully we can have you on the show again in the future just to explore this more. This was amazing.
Thank you so much. I loved this chat, and you were just so, like, you know, in depth and thoughtful and insightful, and just asked such great questions. So I'm honored to be there and have this conversation with you.
Thank you so much. Have a good rest of your day, and I will talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information, you can check out my book, What When Wine, Lose Weight and Feel Great with Paleo Style Meals, Intermittent Fasting, and Wine, as well as my blog, melanieavalon.com. Feel free to contact me at podcast@melanieavalon.com. And always remember, you got this.